On today's College Football Inquirer, is support for a 24-team college football playoff growing? Is the SEC's position that it needs to be 16 dwindling? Plus, the plaintiffs in the House settlement going after the CSC. How much longer can that hold up? Also, guys who produced in college who are going to get underdrafted this weekend, we tell you which players your team should be taking if they want to feel real smart. All on today's College Football Inquirer. This is College Football Inquirer with Steve Godfrey and Ross Dellinger. I am Andy Staples, and Ross is in Dallas, and he is about to head into the Lion's Den, where all of the conference commissioners and the assorted muckety-mucks will be meeting about the college football playoff. And unlike a lot of these meetings, where nothing really happens, Ross, it seems like stuff's happening.
Yeah. Oddly enough, it's happening in another committee. Or at least deep conversations about the playoff is happening in another committee, one created sort of through the White House. I'm not going to say by the White House, but through the White House as a result of the presidential roundtable that happened Friday. There have been six committees created, and one of them is a media committee that includes five conference commissioners, the Power Four and the American commissioner, P. Bavacqua, the Notre Dame athletic director. So those six people are also on the CFP committee, and they're also on this media presidential committee. And on the presidential committee are other folks, business executives and TV executives as well.
Yeah, when you say media, and you're not talking about reporters. You're talking about people who run media.
I should get that clear.
Confused, yes.
ESPN and Fox executives on the presidential media committee. Well, last week, the presidential media committee's main goal is to generate more revenue, find ways to generate more revenue for college sports and to reduce costs. And last week, they got into conversation about the number one way to generate more revenue, expand the playoff to 24 teams. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, most, if not all, people in the room, including those, all those in the CFP committee, the commissioners and Pete Bavacqua, the Notre Dame athletic director, sort of raised their hands for a 2014 playoff, which is a change.
Was Greg Sankey one of these people?
No, Greg Sankey was not on the call. Greg Sankey was
but a Republican. So a Republican political strategist in your story for Yahoo was.
Yes. Boris Epstein. And someone,
and then you have two people labeled as business magnates. Jerry Cardinale, am I saying that right?
And Cardinale. David Blitzer. And David Blitzer.
And what are their backgrounds in college football?
They're in pro sports and PE. No backgrounds in college football.
So private equity.
Yes.
So and then what was the what again in your story it says financially stressed schools? Was there any actual like did they talk about like what number like a data piece of data on financially stressed? Like why are they financially stressed?
Well, I believe there was a bunch of data shared on just typically the quote unquote deficits that schools are facing. So, you know,
well, I forwarded you guys a story last week on the Premier League and how their costs continue to outpace their revenues. I can tell you this right now, because college football is the Premier League just 30 years later.
Yeah.
The costs are always going to outpace the revenues. That's just how it's going to go.
Well, even it was a design. The thing is, and I think what Godfrey may be getting at, right, is like, no matter how much money they have and generate in other places, how much more money, they're going to keep spending the money, right? And so part of this committee, I guess, is to put cost containment things, which is not part of this story and probably this conversation right now, but we'll be at a later date.
Well, Ross, it is only because they're using it as an excuse. It's a cudgel for them to then turn around and say, we got to generate more revenue. When in actuality, what you're doing is you're running a poorly performing business where expenses are completely out of whack. Did anyone discuss not paying the coaches as much?
Right.
Well, no, okay.
Did that come up?
But we are getting sidetracked here because the people listening to the show care about is how many teams will make the playoff.
Yeah, so, they're going to push through.
I promise.
They're going to push this through, right?
We will have that conversation because to answer your question, yes, capping coaching salaries has been discussed.
So, and that is never going to happen because that's illegal.
Yeah, It's an antitrust violation. But if it's in congressional legislation, apparently, the 2014 recommendation, Ross,
is coming because of financial stress, right? That's what we're generating, you know, more this money week, to, late April. Yes.
Right.
Okay, because we need to, because we're broke, right?
Really deep down,
this is the
really,
lie we're selling.
Is that really the reason? The reason's probably
there's lots of reasons, and we can get into them in Ross's story.
Yeah. It's probably more access is a bigger sort of reason behind this.
Yeah. And access for whom? You have a quote from one Eric Shanks in your story. Eric Shanks, of course, the president of Fox Sports. He says, I think 24 solves an enormous amount of problems, including Eric Shanks' biggest problem, that Fox does not have playoff games on its air, which if they go to 24, they could sell some to Fox.
Yes. Yeah. There will be 12 additional games. So we've talked about this 2014 concept for a while now, I think. And there's a few things that have changed over the years, right? It sort of started as one with built-in AQs for the year ago with built-in AQs that were uneven, right? Based on what conference you were in, you got a different number of automatic qualifiers. But then it shifted right to equal automatic qualifiers, and now it's shifted again to more no automatic qualifiers and just at large, take the top 24 schools.
That's the negotiating piece that. And the Big Ten's driving that train. The Big Ten has been driving that train. The SEC does not want 24. They've wanted 16. Mm-hmm. But the SEC has wanted all at large.
Greg Sankey's been pretty clear about that. He's wanted all at large. So the Big Ten's throwing bones at various. I think I'll put it in the story. It's kind of like the Big Ten's playoff pitch has evolved kind of like congressmen, lawmakers tweak legislation to garner the necessary votes for it to pass.
Correct.
That's what we're seeing the Big Ten do. It's changing its playoff pitch based on garnering support.
This is not throwing bones, by the way. This is throwing a giant side of beef at the SEC and saying, hey, because if you look at what's happened since they offered the all-at-large version, what has happened? SEC coaches, SEC athletic directors have come out and said things that they would never have said publicly beforehand.
I'm really confused. I'm going to be honest. I'm very confused, Ross, because at the very top of the story, we're talking about how 16 or 24, right? And the influence of the 14-person presidential media committee, its existence supported by the White House, right? I'm reading from your story here. It's chock-a-block filled with, like, you know, Major League Baseball. We got strategists, all these people. I feel like, am I crazy? Have I had some sort of head injury, guys? I feel like a couple weeks ago, everything was out of control in college sports, and that's why Donald Trump was, you know, blathering on in the White House about all this nonsense in college sports. And so the solution is to make more TV, is to play more games. That's the solution.
One of them,
this is what
I
your
guess.
Story tells me.
Yeah, one yeah. of them. I think one of them is to play more games. And, you know, one of the big arguments is
interesting
how much
solution.
More money. Yeah, yeah. Well, I think it's not the only one. Like I said, we're going to get to the cost containment stuff with coaching salaries at some point, because I think we're going to see
it's
that.
It's illegal. They're not going to do it. We're not going to get to it.
Andy, there's a lot of things illegal they're trying to fit into a college sports bill.
Yeah, it's not going to work.
Yeah, probably not. But hey.
I mean, they can tell you whatever they want to tell you. And then plaintiff's attorneys are just, man, they're at this point, congrats on the lake house. This is hilarious.
But again, the thing is, this dovetails with something that people in college football actually want for college football reasons, whether that be access, whether that be trying to replace conference championship games, because those have been rendered relatively irrelevant because of the larger playoff. But what I find interesting that you reported, Ross, and this has nothing to do with the presidential committee or anything else. Last year, all but one conference wanted a 16-team playoff.
Yeah.
Big Ten wanted a 24-team playoff.
That's the big change here.
It feels now like all but one conference wants a 24-team playoff, and the SEC is the lone holdout. Now, the Big Ten and the SEC have complete control over this thing. So whether the SEC is going to acquiesce to everyone else is another question entirely, but it certainly seems to me like major stakeholders in the SEC have been dropping breadcrumbs along the way the last few weeks and months that suggest they are at least amenable to 24, even if their commissioner is not. And I kind of wonder how that's all going to shake out over the next month or so.
Yeah, commissioner and some of the presidents, right, have been pretty public in not wanting to go beyond 16. But there is a lot of frustration in the league over the moving a 9-game schedule because they thought it would come with playoff expansion. And when it did not, I think the frustration sort of got a little higher. And you're right, Andy, that's the big change here, is that within this presidential committee, we've seen all of a sudden this movement from commissioners and the Notre Dame athletic director that are all on the CFP governance committee change to, you know what? Yeah, let's maybe do this 24 thing. And it's kind of a, you know, three months ago, right? We were all in Miami and we were just seeing what was 10 people corner one person over 16 team playoff in Tony Petitti in the corner. And he didn't budge on it. And now we're starting to maybe see, and I think they're supposed to talk about it here in Dallas at CFP meetings on Wednesday, we're seeing maybe 10 people corner Greg Sankey for 24. That's the big change.
Which
it just happened to come out
in
this presidential committee.
Like,
very big. And to go back to some of Godfrey's points, is the people on this presidential committee
who know a ton about college football.
Having an influence, I guess, on this thinking. This is what came out of the presidential committee last week, is just more momentum without Greg Sankey on the call, more momentum for this 2014 thing. So it'd be interesting what happens if the conversation from the presidential committee carries over to the CFP meetings today or Wednesday when it comes to this 2014 playoffs.
Yeah, I would like to hear like how strongly, let's say, Tim Pernetti from The American feels about this, or how strongly Pete Bevacqua at Notre Dame feels about this. Can it go either way, or are they on board fully with 24? Because I think that's going to tell us, because Greg Sankey is dealing with issues within his own league in terms of, you've had multiple coaches, Kirby Smart probably being the most prominent, saying the 24 feels like the best option. You had Greg Byrne, the athletic director at Alabama, not commenting on 16 or 24, but saying the SEC championship game had basically run its course. Like, that he may as well say it. So that is, I find it fascinating because
Sankey's said, because he's not operating from a position of power currently, which is rare for him.
Yes, correct.
Yeah, yeah. He is a creature of self-preservation. I would assume that we're going to see a pivot pretty soon if consensus builds. He doesn't want to be on the wrong side of a development this big. For sure.
But it's interesting because, like, we have not seen this in the SEC
in a long time.
The commissioner who has a pretty well-held, staked-out position needed to bend. And this might be the first... I'm trying to think if this is the first time in Sankey's tenure that he's had to do that, or had been put in that position where he might have to do that.
Out externally, I would say yes. Internally, I would say no. There have been issues before where he's had to reposition himself because of the membership, but externally, no. Ross, you have a line in here buried down in here. Sankey missed the call last week on the presidential committee, but he wasn't alone. And then you have a very telling line in here. Mm-hmm. Okay. Sankey wasn't the lone member to miss this presidential committee call. Jimmy Pitaro, the ESPN chairman, was absent as well. A possible intentional move, this is what Ross writes, to avoid the appearance of legal issues, such as collusion. Can you walk that out for me, Ross? Why would ESPN be accused of collusion here?
Let's walk it out. Competitors in a market are not allowed to get together and talk about conspiring to change the market, I believe is as simple maybe as I could put it. And so the lawyer, I've heard the legal at Fox and perhaps ESPN too, but definitely Fox, have informed their executives that they believe this could be seen as a collusion. So those two did not show up, and perhaps Greg Sankey in a similar fashion decided to not show up as well. So there's some drama for sure around this presidential committee, and if it is even sort of quote unquote legal.
Why now, Ross, are they concerned about the appearance of collusion? Like, can you explain to our audience the invisible line that they've crossed? Because for years, it's been somewhat obvious that, you know, ESPN is operating, you know, at every step of the process,
this is ESPN,
if you will.
Fox, not
right.
Because Eric Shanks also wasn't on it either. This is ESPN and Fox.
Right. It's both of them.
But is it because of the concentration of inventory, Ross? Because those two entities basically control the overwhelming majority of the inventory?
Yeah, 80%. Yeah, 80% of college football, basically. I think something like that. I would guess that is a big reason why.
I don't think ESPN wants this 24 because it lets Fox into the hen house. See what I did there?
Yeah, well, they don't have anywhere to put it right now. That was excellent, by the way, Andy.
Yeah.
Good job.
Yeah, very good.
Thank you.
I mean, remember a couple things. Pending what's going to happen with the merger with Paramount and Warners, which Paramount, if you're not in the whole Hollywood world, that's fine. So Paramount, think CBS, right? Warner, think HBO, TNT. ESPN is already sub-licensing some of its inventory in early December to a competing media conglomerate. Specifically because they didn't want to bump into their own NFL inventory. So it does not serve ESPN currently to expand this playoff unless something were to change for them, I would say somewhat seismically, because you've got to fit this. You first off, you're going to have to pay for it. We should mention that, Andy, right? Like, you're going to have to pay for this top dollar, yep. And then you're going to have to make that worth your while, and to achieve ROI on the individual games that we're talking about expanding to, so like an excess of first and second round games, think about it that way, you're going to have to find a place to put them. And ESPN quietly is already sort of stressed because they don't know what to do with the inventory they have.
Yeah, they're selling it off, right? I mean, they sold off a semifinal in back-to-back years, I believe, maybe. Or maybe the last 4 years. Can't remember exactly what it is. But they've sold off a lot of games. Godfrey, this leads into another great topic, which I didn't get really deep into my story, but I think is really interesting. How much are 12 additional teams, and thus 12 additional games, worth in a 2014 playoff? Will they even cover the amount in that you're losing because you've eliminated your conference championship
games? And Ross, I know you talk to the very smart TV consultants and media rights consultants, and they will tell you that the value of these games diminishes significantly the farther you get into the bracket.
I would also bet my mortgage and one of my kids, I'll go pick which one, that these media consultants are telling ESPN and Fox, this bet these helmets on this field, on these games, they better look shiny and recognizable, okay? Mm-hmm. If there is expansion, it is going to be a default mode setting towards the brand you know. This is not to land more people at the table.
Yeah, there would have been a Vandy Virginia game in the first round of the last playoff, and I'm not sure that's going to move the needle. So,
right. And Iowa would play at, I don't know, was it Miami maybe? Or I can't remember.
Iowa lost four games.
Yeah.
That place.
But yeah.
That place.
Well, so here's the deal is that it's estimated that the four Power Conference championship games total value annually is about $150 to $200 million. So there's a pretty good thought that you should cover that in a 12
team. They'll cover that just because the prices are going up. They need a Netflix or a Prime Video.
But how much more?
I
don't know how much more. It depends on who you talk to, because I don't know how much more you would really get than that $200 million. Would you get up to $300-500 million? And then you guys saw in there, the Presidential Media Committee also has another idea that's not anything new, but they've been discussing it. It is a group of six playoff. A separate group of six playoff. And so you throw in bidding
throw
in all that, whatever.
That's a group of six playoff where that determines a bid into the larger bracket. Am I correct?
No, probably not.
This is a completely
not.
Separate thing.
This would be a separate thing, which devalues the whole thing.
Yeah, I can report in talking to these school presidents and athletic directors and coaches, no, they're not going to do it. They're not going
to
do it.
And it won't be as much. It won't be enough money to do it, I don't think.
They will walk from that immediately.
You just saw for 2027, the Football Oversight Committee wants to move week one to week zero. They're already shifting the schedule.
Yeah.
The NFL is about to try to squeeze all of its media rights partners because it's got opt-outs in all its deals. The Paramount deal you referenced, Godfrey, triggers an opt-out or triggers a renegotiation. So they're going to get squeezed first. Then Fox is going to get squeezed next. Prime Video may or may not want to get involved more. Netflix may or may not want to get involved. What I'm saying is the price of the NFL is about to go way up.
Yep.
And it may leave somebody out, like a broadcast network out. And
yes,
they may need to replace that with premium college football inventory. So this is why, Ross, the environment that's coming suggests that there is more money in the banana stand.
But see, I would push back a little bit, Andy. The NFL is already having some interest drawn from a very conservative Washington, D.C. at present.
It is purely grandstanding.
Hang on.
Yep.
One minor headline. Netflix did not meet its goals on viewership with that NFL inventory over the holidays. They actually had to do a make good, and that involved, I'm talking about with their advertisers.
The bar
has been set so high by the premium price that the NFL is charging now. If they expand much more, it's twofold. It's the problem you mentioned, which is that some people are going to be left out from a consumer or for, like, networks buying in. The other problem is there's only so many platforms that can achieve the standard to make it break even or even worthwhile. So I think if anything, we might be on the cusp of a market correction. And again, Andy, you mentioned week zero.
They're going to get more money.
You mentioned week zero.
Mm-hmm.
We still have a huge scheduling and inventory problem, even if we move to week zero. We have to eliminate the conference championship games. We can't just talk about it. By the way, Ross, that line in there in the story about, what did you say, it was about $150 million combined for the power championship games. That's a hilariously drawn pie. Because there's one slice that's worth more in the SEC.
80 to 90.
I'll give them credit for that.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, the estimate.
Yeah, I don't think anyone's like, we're going to lose the ACC championship game. It's so valuable.
Like half of it. Yeah. Half of it is SEC. A third of it's probably Big Ten. And then, 20, 25% is probably the two others. Yeah.
Well, it is going to be fascinating to watch this happen. Ross, we don't think anything's actually going to be decided in this meeting, but do we think we know where the wind will be blowing by the end of this meeting?
Yeah, there'll be no decisions, I'm sure. They have a agenda time slot, a pretty big chunk of it, I believe, on Wednesday to talk about format. And I would guess the conversation from the presidential committee will carry over and that we'll see a push for 24, which again, a stark change from just 3 months ago. We saw such a push for 16. Andy, earlier you asked about Pernetti and the group of six and how they feel about this. I think they'd be all on board if they were to get two, not one, automatic qualifiers. Yeah. Now, they might not need it, right? This past year, they would have gotten two. Tulane in JMU were both in the top 24, but they're going to want some kind of guarantee.
Ross, they will need it. Remember what I just said, there will be an internal push to avoid inclusion at all costs unless stipulated in a contract somewhere that group of six programs are involved. If they got two, they should absolutely take it.
Yeah.
Oh,
they will. By the way,
I think you're going to get one. That's probably what it gets settled on.
And people will complain about that too. Yeah.
But I want to see where this is at the end of this thing, because it is a fairly shocking turnaround.
Yeah.
In a 3 month period.
Hey, just to review, Andy, if you're a casual listening to this, and you don't work in the industry, the playoff is not changing this fall. Response.
Yeah.
We need to be clear about this. So if you are just a consumer, it's a 12 team this fall. It's not changing this season. We are not talking about the coming season.
But this could be as early as the 2027 season. So
yes. Yeah. But I want to reiterate, because I get that question a lot on social we're done. Like, so what's going to happen? 12 is locked for this year. Okay.
Yep.
And Notre Dame's probably going to make it now, but that's a whole other conversation.
That's right.
That's the big change.
When we come back, Ross talked to a very important lawyer. It's surprising what's happened with the playoff. What we're about to talk about is completely unsurprising. The CFC may be falling apart. We'll talk about it when we come back. are back with College Football Inquirer, and Ross Dellinger had a very interesting conversation with one Jeffrey Kessler. If you do not know who Jeffrey Kessler is, he is the man who brought free agency to the NFL. He's been involved in almost every major sports antitrust case that you can think of, including House versus the NCAA. And now he is taking aim at the, it's not the NCAA, but we created something that's kind of like the NCAA piece of the House settlement, the CSC, the College Sports Commission, that is supposed to police how schools pay players. How is Jeffrey Kessler attacking that particular entity, Ross?
Well, he's saying that the College Sports Commission is being too restrictive on athlete deals. Specifically, he's saying that the only deals that should get rigorous like review and have this high standard and threshold to meet are deals directly from boosters or from booster collectives. Everything else should be going right through. Multimedia rights partner deals, corporate sponsor deals, apparel brands should all be getting almost no scrutiny from the College Sports Commission, which if that happens, of course, you might as well not even have a cap.
So
you don't have a cap. It doesn't exist. Sorry.
Let me translate for the casual listener again.
Yeah.
MMR is a multimedia rights company. Mm-hmm. Most of the schools have these. What they used to do is take a guaranteed amount of money from these schools and from these entities, Learfield, Playfly, those are the two big ones right now. Those entities would then go sell sponsorships against the school, you know, against the total. And the school would get a guaranteed amount of money. The entities would get whatever they eat, whatever they kill. It is morphed in the age of NIL and revenue sharing into essentially a pass-through. So these MMR companies pay the players and the schools say, oh, we're not, that's not us. That's in addition to the money we're allowed to pay under the House settlement. And so what Jeffrey Kessler's arguing is that these entities that are essentially an arm of the school based on their business relationship should just be able to pay the players whatever they want. As a capitalist, I'm fine with that.
Yeah,
but I can see where the CSC would have a problem with that.
Well, they shouldn't exist anyway. That's a bunch of annoying regulatory bodies that capitalists don't like. So correct. Get rid of them.
Yeah, so it's going to happen, clear, right, Ross? To be clear too, like Jeff Kessler is asking a judge who's presiding over the settlement to make this determination, and it'll unfold in a hearing. The arguments from probably the NCAA conference side versus the Kessler side on May 27th. So for the next 5 weeks, you know, there probably won't be a change, much of a change.
Can I ask a dumb question? So you mentioned the NCAA. It's the NCAA and the conferences that are the defendants in this case.
The defendants
settled
in the case.
And they created the CSC alongside the House plaintiffs.
Specifically, the power conferences created the CSC. Yeah.
Right. And those are the schools, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those are the schools that signed deals with Learfield and Playfly.
That's right.
That basically have ordered Learfield and Playfly to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Why do they care? This is what they want.
Because they want someone to blame.
This is what they want.
They want someone to blame, and they don't want the responsibility. They need a strong.
Well, think about it. They constructed, you know, say the CSC is a house, and the builders constructed the house, and the builders are now tearing it down one piece at a time. Mm-hmm. And on May 27th, the whole thing could just come down.
Having been around some builders, this is actually how they operate. Like, they build themselves a house and then they move after a year. So this is par for the course.
Yeah. Yeah, but they don't burn it down usually. They usually just sell it, Andy.
Yeah. That's true.
They don't strip that's it right. For parts.
they're not actively pouring gasoline in the kitchen.
We should have all knew this is coming. And I think us three sort of knew this is coming back in August, September-ish, when not every school signed the CSC participation agreement. That would
the blood pact.
waive their right to sue the CSC and agree to follow all these rules no matter what. As soon as that happened, it was pretty clear where this was going, and we're almost there.
Yeah, and the apparel one's great too, because like, why are schools switching from Nike to Adidas when everyone knows Adidas makes really ugly uniforms? Because Adidas will pay your players more.
Like, yeah, directly. Get used to them stripes, baby. Pretty sure it was an Adidas on Adidas national championship, and that wasn't a coincidence.
It sure was. I saw one guy wearing the mom two different teams thing, and I was like, who is this guy? It was the CEO of Adidas. He was down on the sideline before the game.
Hell yeah.
Very German guy.
Make
very
German money.
So a lot of the reaction to the filing yesterday by Kessler and Berman has been pretty fascinating. Administrators have spent the last 9 months breaking apart spending time and resources on breaking apart these big deals for their athletes into little tiny deals and submitting them so they could get through in NIL Go. If they don't have to do that, it saves them hours and hours and hours. So there's been a kind of a like sort of quiet celebration already from the administrators, which again tells you all you need to know that from the
get-go, this
was not going to work. Right.
Now, Brian Seely, who runs the CSC and who I sort of feel bad for, but I guess the checks are clearing. He told you, and I thought he made a good point, that they're basically trying to take this into federal court when it's supposed to be handled by arbitration. They're basically trying to bypass arbitration, go to the federal court system.
Yes.
Which, look, that's what Jeff Kessler gets paid to do.
And if you read the settlement, there is one line in there, right, that does say that the CSC has authority to enforce matters, deals, and reject deals if they are for recruiting or retention purposes. It does say that in there. Now, again, we could probably argue how ridiculous of a line that is in a settlement to begin with. But it was in there, and so Seely's, I think, thought is, we are just following by that concept, and it should be decided by an arbitrator, not a judge.
Yeah, great. I got nothing. This is the inevitable conclusion to a dumb plan, and what I'm happy about is that it seems to... This is going to introduce, I think, a faster and cleaner resolution to a problem we knew was never... to a problem, I should say. Like the concept introduced of the straw man, to go back to how I described it at the beginning of the segment, was never going to last. We all knew this. We knew it was going to get challenged. This is just a faster means of upending that and moving on to a free market economy, which is what everybody wanted, right? That's what you guys love. You want to pay coaches $200 million? Let's go, baby.
Yep.
Start buying them running backs.
am I the only person who actually likes this?
Think about
I'm not tongue in cheek about this. If you want to pay these players, and I've got to go do a hit on Yahoo Sports Daily about this and radio hits, and people are like, why is the draft class so boring? Is NIL ruining it? I was like, not college football's concern. Get your money where it's paid to you. That's all you have to worry about. It is not, you know what? If the draft is a boring TV event this year, that's not college football problem. That's not their problem. That's the NFL's problem.
Quarterback problem anyway. We're going to talk about that in a second, actually.
Yeah. Oh, jinx. We are going to talk about that in a second. Yeah.
So, now, blame Dabo. So we'll watch what happens here. But we've told you on this show, even Ross, and Ross is usually fairly nice to these people, but
I'm not.
We've told you this was going to happen, and it's going to happen. So,
I mean,
The fact this filing comes like probably a week and a half before Nebraska was supposed to have its arbitration hearing. I don't know how this impacts Nebraska's arbitration. The CSC wasn't sure either, so we'll see how that goes. But the fact that it was dropped now, I think the Nebraska arbitration case, which involves multimedia rights partners, is a big reason why this happened.
I do love the all of this, because I remember talking to some true believers when the House settlement was initially agreed upon, mm-hmm. and they said, well, we are in league with the plaintiff's attorneys. They are helping us craft this model, and therefore it will hold up. I'm like, I bring this fable up a lot, the scorpion and the frog, And
who's the scorpion?
Well, I don't mean to portray anyone as a scorpion.
Who's the scorpion?
Two scorpions, Godfrey. They're both scorpions.
Entities tend to do what is in their nature, is all I'm saying.
And what's really funny, Andy, is to,
go ahead.
This is a great point. Within the settlement, there's a line that says that the attorneys, the plaintiff attorneys that were sitting across the table, obviously from the NCAA and the conferences and striking this deal, that they, as part of the settlement, were supposed to help the NCAA and conferences lobby for a congressional bill, right, in Congress. It wasn't a month in, I kid you not, it wasn't a month in to the settlement being struck when I was in D.C., you know, gallivanting across Capitol Hill, and somebody mentioned, oh, the plaintiff attorneys were up here lobbying against the conferences.
Why'd you sting me? Bro, I'm a scorpion.
Yeah. Be really, just to tie these two segments today together, I guess that presidential media committee and all those Republican strategists, I guess you better ask for 45 playoff games, maybe 64 playoff games, because the price of the bricks going up. And you don't want to pay your coaches less. You don't want to stop building stuff. You don't want to stop showing a zero balance sheet. So guess what? You better let all 136 teams in the playoff, because guess what? Turns out you're going to have to pay the labor what they're worth now. Sorry, guys.
Well, yes, we know that. But stop with the more playoff. I don't know.
Andy, I don't want
it to go past 12.
Andy, I am only echoing what the presidential media committee has recommended, and they are the smartest people in the room. I want corporate executives, I want ex-MLB officials, and I want Republican strategists running college football, Andy. That's what's best for America.
They're telling us to expand the playoff all along. Good Lord.
You're right. And I guess what? This is the only solution they've provided. I'll see you guys at the October 1st playoff game.
When we come back, we will provide solutions, damn it, to NFL teams complaining that this is a boring draft. They're actually not all complaining. They think it's a fairly deep one.
Yeah.
You're just not, you, the viewer, might be a little bored because of the quarterbacks. We'll talk about it when we come back. We're back at the College Football Inquirer. Ross Dellinger had to go meet up with all the commissioners.
He did some journalism.
Fancy hotel in Dallas. But we got to talk a little draft. The NFL draft is Thursday, or starts Thursday. A lot of the guys we're going to be talking about are going to be drafted Friday and Saturday, Stephen Godfrey. I feel like there's a little bit of a lack of buzz about this draft, and I feel like it's just because it's not a big quarterback class. Last year's wasn't either. I think in NFL circles, you may get some more buzz as we get closer, because I think there may be some more trades. You had the big Dexter Lawrence to the Bengals trade for the number 10 pick this weekend. But that is probably how that they're going to generate the interest, because I do feel like drafts are almost exclusively quarterback driven in terms of interest. And so you have Fernando Mendoza going number one. We will see where Ty Simpson goes. This is one of those situations where it's probably a big gap between first quarterback taken at number one and the next quarterback taken. But we were talking before the segment about Garrett Nussmeier, the former LSU quarterback, because there was news that came out on Monday from Tom Pelissero of the NFL Network that Garrett Nussmeier had a cyst on his spine that caused a lot of the issues that he was having this year. Now, look, we do get these in pre-draft season where injuries that were not revealed during the season are, by the way, here's this laundry list of things that was actually going on.
Yeah.
But with Nussmeier, it's fascinating because, look, the guy was going to try to play through whatever, and he was clearly trying to play through a lot.
Yeah, and I'm going to do my best to avoid talking about the Brian Kelly personnel management theory, but we can maybe discuss that in a future segment, because there's a pretty alarming through line of players under Brian Kelly. But let me just read, it's a two-word quote. Nussmeier was feeling, quote, a stabbing pain, specifically when he threw the ball.
Ow.
Seems tough for a quarterback. So I think that, to go back to what you said about quarterbacks, I have done a few like radio hits and that kind of thing. And people, they always bring on like a college football. I mean, you've done this 1,000 times. They bring on a college football person and you can always tell who's more NFL adjacent or more NFL driven in the media where they say, what's wrong with college football? I get that a lot. But they're not talking about all the stuff we talked about for the last two segments. They're just talking
actually,
about
Yahoo. Well, Yahoo's putting out a segment that Nate Tice and I did this week where we talk about this. We talk about why certain players flame out, even though they put up gonzo numbers in college football, why they flame out in the NFL. And it's not that there's anything wrong with college football. It's just that in a lot of cases, they're two different sports and some people are not equipped to make the transition.
Your job in college football is not to fortify the ranks of the NFL. The NFL pays $0 to college football. It is a completely free development league, unlike any other sport in the world.
Yeah.
And college football is trying to be good at college football. So let's talk about quarterbacks for a second.
And college football says, you're welcome for handing you these incredibly well-marketed individuals that you don't really have to market now.
And the NFL has shirked so many, let's call it responsibilities within that transition. We did a whole episode of our miniseries, Who Killed College Football. We had the NFL as a suspect. And I think casual fans would be shocked to know how many times the NFL has skirted any responsibility at this level whatsoever.
I was laughing at one. There was a story, and I can't even remember where I read it, but it was one of those, you know, anonymous NFL people rip on NIL because it's causing them to have thinner draft pools.
This is what I want to talk about.
One guy goes, I don't think these college guys understand that the market, that they're not being marketed as well as if they came to the NFL. talking about
they're getting money. You market yourself to get the money,
and they're being marketed perfectly well in the second most popular sport in America. Like college football is more popular than the NBA.
I guarantee you that individual lives in like Connecticut or something. Okay, so let's talk about quarterback for a second. Nobody expected Fernando Mendoza to be the number one overall pick this time last year. A lot of people actually expected Garrett Nussmeier. What's interesting about this quarterback class, Andy, is I think NIL and the portal, we're getting a lot of red herrings blaming the shallowness of this quarterback depth.
Right. But I think Dante Moore just didn't want to be a Jet.
So let's talk about Dante Moore for a second. Dante Moore specifically is maybe the one player that if you added to this draft, everyone would say, hey, you know, it's a pretty good draft. Like casual would say, there's that guy from Oregon. They were in the playoff, and then you have Mendoza. Dante Moore electing to stay at Oregon, really specifically so he would not have to become a New York Jet, is the difference of quality, I think, at least in terms of perception. Now, there's two other names, if you are a college football fan, that you know would have not only buoyed this class in terms of name recognition, they would have made it a quarterback-driven class, and that's Drew Aller at Penn State and Cade Klubnik at Clemson. And before you get into Dante Moore deciding, hey, I can get paid here at Oregon, I can continue my development, or a guy like Trinidad Chambliss, right, who came back, who would not have been a top 10 pick. He would not have been that high up, but he would have been involved. So
he
before
would have been
you
a very
get
intriguing pick because
yes,
like I'll go back to 2016 when Dak Prescott got drafted. I just couldn't understand because Prescott had a DUI, I believe, before the draft.
Yeah.
But he already was considered like a third or fourth round guy.
Right.
And I didn't understand that because here was this guy who had elevated Mississippi State.
I know.
And had this incredible, like to use a basketball term, an incredible usage rate. Like it wasn't because of some weird scheme. It wasn't because of it. Like he was just making them better as the quarterback. And I didn't get it. Like what are we missing here?
Well, this goes back to the complaint about the supply that you're receiving for free. This was the complaint against Jared Goff the year that he went overall because the system that he ran at Cal, which was basically the Dykes air raid at the time, was really like that was a dirty word in the NFL was air raid.
That was
right?
pre-Mahomes, so it wasn't okay yet. Yeah.
So if you go through this class, it's not historically shallow. It's just you've had some developmental issues with guys like Aller not working out, obviously coming off of an injury. Really, if you're talking about developmental issues, you have to talk about Cade Klubnik. I don't talk to a lot of NFL people, but the people I do have said that that's their sort of buyer beware. And then this is how you end up, of course, Indiana having this like generational seismic event of NIL and developing. Utilizing Fernando Mendoza. I don't want to say like he had a great raw skill set at Cal.
He was a pretty good quarterback at Cal.
Yeah.
But it didn't manifest itself into what we saw until he got to Indiana.
Now, in terms of if you're listening to this or watching this because you've got some college football guys and you're looking for, hey, man, show me the bargain bin. I'm going to shop for the lower shelf stuff, but let me, you know, tell me what still tastes premium. It's Garrett Nussmeier. I think Garrett Nussmeier was a fantastic quarterback in college before this season. I think Garrett Nussmeier was on his way to breaking out and becoming the number one pick. And then I think Murphy's Law shook Garrett Nussmeier for all he was worth at LSU. But if he's healthy, I still really like him as a prospect.
In terms of like, who could I see being an NFL starter? It is Fernando Mendoza. It's Ty Simpson. And it is probably Garrett Nussmeier. That's probably it of the quarterbacks coming out.
Yes. I think everything else is, you know, I'm sure Miller Moss is going to make a roster.
Right. You know, Carson Beck's going to make a roster, but I don't necessarily see Carson Beck as an NFL starter for a long time.
I mean, there are names that college fans are going to say like, hey, wouldn't this work out? But then I go to NFL people and they say, here's why. So like Jalen Daniels, Sawyer Robertson, Talon Green. The talent is there, but these are the guys who kind of, they're separated off.
Right. Talon Green, from an athletic standpoint, this is the Arkansas quarterback. He's 6 foot six. He's 230. He runs really fast. Yeah. I mean, from an athletic standpoint, from an arm standpoint, he's got everything. But he was playing in Bobby Petrino's offense. So an offense that translates very well to the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, too many turnovers, doesn't take care of the ball well enough. Like, it's that part rarely changes when you go from one move to the other or one spot to the other. So I'm just the quarterback stuff, there may be a deeper quarterback class last year, but we said that this time last year about, because we thought Aller and Klubnik would be factors, and they weren't.
Yes. So I'm going to do something real fast, then we're going to move on to non-quarterback players. I'm going to read next year's projections at quarterback, and you tell me to stop when you think someone won't make a roster.
Okay.
All right. Julian Sain, Dante Moore, Arch Manning,
mm-hmm.
CJ Carr,
mm-hmm.
Jaden Maivea,
mm-hmm.
Lenore Sellers,
mm-hmm.
Drew Mestemaker, Sam mm-hmm. Levitt, and he'll be in Lane's office.
These are all making rosters. And I think you've actually named a lot more guys who I think could become actual NFL starters than in this year's draft.
So, but this is my point, by the way. And you hadn't said stop. You haven't said stop yet. Sam Levitt, John Mateer.
I'm not stopping you.
Okay. Brandon Sorsby, Trinidad Chambliss,
mm-hmm.
Byron Brown, because
Okay, there's where you stop.
You stop there?
Byron Brown throws from his waist. Like, he could be very effective.
But that was 11 guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. That was 11 guys.
But some of these are going to fall off.
Yeah.
Somebody we're not talking about is going to rise up.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is that right now, almost, I think it's impossible now for the 27 class not to maybe double its output in quarterbacks, if not triple, than what we're looking at this year.
Well, it also tends to even out. Like, there weren't a lot last year. The year before, there were a ton. Was it 5 quarterbacks in the top 12?
It was a couple years ago. And then,
It was Caleb Williams, Drake May, Jalen Daniels, Michael Penix Jr., and Bo Nix. Like, that. And they're all starting quarterbacks in the NFL, and most of them
Jalen
are actually
Daniels,
really good.
By the way. Yeah, there's 2 Jalen Daniels.
Jaden Daniels, not
yeah,
Jalen Daniels.
Jalen
Daniels
yeah.
is the Kansas quarterback coming out this year.
Yeah. So I don't think there's a crisis. I feel like, there's an allegation there's a crisis in personnel development against college about every other year, but that's just NFL wonks. Now, Andy, let's talk about, I love these segments because it's basically just remember some guys who we aren't really forgetting yet, right? Take me through. You have non-quarterback guys that are way down, starting with another LSU guy, right?
Let's start at LSU.
Yeah.
What is Harold Perkins Jr. in the NFL? Because this guy's going to probably go in round 5. Remember when Harold Perkins Jr. was a freshman and they mm-hmm. played Arkansas and he single-handedly saved them against Arkansas? And you thought, this guy's going to wreck everything forever.
Oh, the internet thought he was Jadeveon Clowney.
Yeah.
He was the next. It's funny because you said this at the beginning of the segment, and I wanted to push back a little. I feel like you get a quarterback level of excitement if you have a pass rush dominant defensive end, like a game breaker. defensive end. That used to garner a quarterback level of excitement. So
here's the thing. Harold Perkins Jr. can be a very successful NFL player.
Yeah.
But, and this is the but with most of these guys I'm going to mention, like fourth round down.
Mm-hmm.
The right team has to take him.
Yes.
The team that runs the correct kind of defense, the team that has a defensive coordinator who's willing to be a little bit creative and see where this person fits. Here's the thing with Harold Perkins Jr. We knew even when he was doing that as a freshman, mm-hmm. that he was never going to be that in the NFL. You are not putting Harold Perkins Jr. on the line of scrimmage every play in the NFL. He is 223 pounds.
Correct.
He would get murdered. So you have to figure out a way to use him, and it's basically play Where's Waldo with him. He'll be a linebacker, but you make him a bigger honey badger, essentially, to call back to another LSU person. Make him a bigger honey badger who plays all and be a see ball, get ball guy,
mm-hmm.
but who moves around, who is not just lining up on the line of scrimmage, where if you see him on the line of scrimmage, you're like, oh, I'm going to check to a run and just batter him with 600 pounds of human.
Correct. Yeah. And this is where I acknowledge every time I do one of these spots, I'm stepping out of my depth, but I do watch the NFL every Sunday. And this feels like Philadelphia Eagles project, right? This feels like, let's take him in the
you
fifth.
Have fun with him.
Yeah. You know, Vic Fangio.
SEC school, though.
I know. Yeah. Well, I think they have one or two Georgia projections in their draft class again this season. This feels like where he could be utilized as an occasional tool, as you're describing, in the Vic Fangio defense versus sort of turning him into a pass rush specialist. Where, like, I don't know size wise if that's going to work.
He's just not big enough, and that's the thing that I'm happy as a college football wonk, as a lover of college football, I understand that there are certain physical limitations that cannot be overcome in the NFL.
Yes. That's okay. We're not playing the NFL. We're playing college. And you know what, Andy? This is another one. Go back. Remember the criticism that the various coaching staffs, because I'm blanking the defensive coordinator before Baker at LSU. Like, everybody took it as basically the moment that Harold Perkins didn't become Jadeveon Clowney, right? There was criticism mm-hmm.
Matt
against...
House.
Yes, Matt House. Thank you. I knew who has NFL experience, who came from the Chiefs staff. He had NFL experience before he came down. Everybody had a criticism of how he was being handled in preparation for the NFL draft. If you go back, there were headlines as early as his first year in Baton Rouge about his NFL development side and how is this going to affect our recruiting, because there's always, you know, that whole specter of Saban of constantly plugging guys into the NFL.
And Harold Perkins was a big-time recruit as well.
Yes, but the problem was that in as many words, Baker and House, and I remember even Kelly talking about this at the time, it's like, hey, we're trying to position him to where he works the best for us. So if his stats don't conform accordingly to where he has an explosive amount of X or Y, or he's not rushing the passer as often as you think he should, we don't care. We're trying to win football games now. He's another great example of that.
Let me give you one, though, that actually, there shouldn't be a problem. This is more of a positional value thing.
Okay.
So one of the big free agent moves in the NFL was Tyler Linderbaum leaving the Ravens to go to the Raiders. Tyler Linderbaum, the center who was from Iowa. He was the Remington Trophy winner at Iowa. Remington Trophy goes to the best center in the country. Well, Iowa had its next Remington Trophy winner this past year in Logan Jones. Logan Jones is not quite as big as Tyler Linderbaum. He does not have the ideal physical characteristics that Tyler Linderbaum has, but you know what he's really good at? Snapping a football and knocking the crap out of somebody. So 299 pounds, slightly undersized, but it's fine. If you need a starting center that you would like to be your starting center for 10 years, all you got to do is take Logan Jones. Like, Ravens, if you'd like to replace Tyler Linderbaum, just take Logan Jones. And he's probably going to be available. Like, the projected round on him is 4. Like, you could grab him in the third and know you got a starting. Like, I don't think people understand. There's only one other person who touches the ball on every play besides the quarterback.
Yeah.
It's more important than people realize.
So I was going through lists for this, and the only one that jumped out at center that I was going through lists before the show would be in your neck of the woods, Jake Slaughter, who could play
Jake
center,
Slaughter,
right?
Very good. Jake Slaughter probably okay, yeah. picked higher than that.
Yes.
Because he has more the more physical ideal in terms of the body. And he's very good. Trey Zune is another one. He played left tackle at Texas A&M. He's probably going to go higher than Logan Jones because he's probably going to play center or guard in the NFL, but he played left tackle in the SEC for 2 years. So if your tackle gets hurt and you got to throw somebody out there, you have somebody you can throw out there. So Trey Zune's another one from A&M. Like, that's a bargain. If you get him in the third round, you got a deal.
I always feel like I'm completely out of my depth when I'm trying to do this or provide insight. So I usually just ask people. I just mm-hmm. become a conduit for the people that I talk to because I've never once been paid in my career to evaluate NFL talent. There were two receivers that probably are slept on unless you follow these teams. Cyrus Allen at Cincinnati and mm-hmm. Skylar Bell at UConn. Those came up when I was asking. And I, of course, you know, me being me, I sort of started in that like group of range where I was like, what's a guy who's going to show up and end up getting to a second contract and someone that like is a number two or three option who, you know, becomes a fan favorite in some NFL city. And those were two names that I got.
Yeah. And receiver is tough because it is a high value position. You're going to see receivers way overdrafted in this draft. But pass catching options aren't necessarily receivers. Could be a lot of things.
Go transition.
I want to put one, a guy in your wheelhouse.
Okay.
This is a guy who's probably going in the sixth or seventh round. Eli Heidenreich from Navy.
Yes. I would love this for a number of reasons.
Receiving with 51 catches for 941 yards. Let me repeat that. Service Academy player, 51 catches for 941 yards. This is the equivalent of catching 100 passes for 2,000 yards in any other offense.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. Maybe we do have to explain why how that statistical anomaly appears, but that's because when you're in that style of offense, you're gonna catch some chunk yardage plays for sure.
But Eli Heidenreich is not necessarily a receiver at the NFL level. He's a third down weapon.
Yeah.
Is what he is.
He
is line him up at running back, but motion him out into the slot. You will find something to do with him. This is not a try hard guy. Like he's legit fast. So this is going to be an interesting one to see what he ends up becoming.
Gadget player. Low rounds. Someone who works creative offense.
He'll be good on all the special teams, but how do you utilize him? Because there is a way to utilize him on a down-to-down basis because you mm-hmm. can move him around within the offense and it changes essentially changes your personnel grouping without moving people off the field, and that is how you drive a defensive coordinator insane.
I mean, there's a couple... This feels like you would go to... With him, I would go to, again, it's kind of like the Eagles thing with Perkins. You go to an established offense where they're creative and he's not relied upon to do one mm-hmm. thing. So this is a guy you take like a, how low are we going to go here? Sixth round fly?
I mean, the Eagles are kind of doing that with Will Shipley now.
Yeah.
So
there's precedent for this. Also, I would love this just because if you get one of the Service Academy guys in the league once every 5 years, it just sort of reinforces the entire concept for those three academies to like, justify their existence at the FBS level. So yeah, I would love this.
One more.
Okay.
Another pass catching option. This is going to be a little higher up in the draft and then we got to go. But Max Clair, the tight end from Ohio State. Max Clair had 448 catches for 448 yards. So he was the third leading receiver in Ohio State's offense. The leading receiver was Jeremiah Smith, of course, who will be the wide receiver one next year and possibly one of one next year.
Yeah.
And the other leading receiver was Carnell Tate, who will be first or second receiver off the board this year. I think Max Clair will probably wind up in a less talented receiving corps in the NFL than he was at Ohio State.
Possibly.
He could have better numbers in the NFL is all I'm saying.
Can you imagine having that... Can you imagine transferring into that situation and then becoming like you go from Purdue, you go to Ohio State, you go to the biggest brand in college football, and basically no one knows who you are, maybe outside of Columbus specifically because of the like once in a lifetime depth that they have at this position. Yeah. Well, not tight end, but at basket, yeah, receiver.
So yeah, the fact that he was able to become an integral,
yeah,
critical part of that group,
yes,
tells you he's really freaking good. And you may be able to get him in the third round.
Yeah, I'm looking at projections right now. Yeah, this is excellent choice here. I like this.
Yeah, so this it's going to be fun. So we've given you something Friday night and Saturday to pay attention to. Yeah. Also, pay attention. We'll probably be talking about this on Tuesday of next week because I want to know what the final total is. Because I always believe, like, I hate the conference superiority argument. I think it's stupid. The mm-hmm. only time it matters to me is how many players from each league got drafted, because people's paychecks depend on how good of players they take. And it was a 7-player difference between the SEC and the Big Ten last year.
Yeah.
The SEC has had the most players drafted every year since 2005. Is that changing this year or not? I don't think it is. I think the SEC still winds up on top, but okay, I'm not willing to go out on a limb and say definitely. I want to see it.
Totally in support of this, and I agree, it's one of the few times you can actually measure conferences. Maybe we put, not an asterisk, but one thing to look at is that in those totals, what is the ratio of transfers? I'm going to be curious about that. Like, how many guys are coming in?
The dynamics have changed completely because I went back to 2004 just to see what the breakdown was. Holy crap, there were a lot of Big East players back in the day when Miami was in the Big East and Virginia Tech in the Big East. So that's...
Are we moving towards a finishing school type of like methodology where you're kind of crawling up the ladder? Yeah. I'm curious about that.
I would say yes. So... we'll see. But Thursday, Ross will have an update from the meetings in Dallas. We'll talk more about the college football playoff because it does seem like things are moving and shaking there a little bit. And then it'll be draft time. We'll talk to you on Thursday.